years, except it was something like this. God said it through the Pope. I believe it, and that settles it. Okay? And so people now were thinking, you know, God said it through the Reformation or through the Pope, and consequently that settled it, and that made them fight. You know, the Reformers fought the Catholic Church and vice versa, and these wars made people doubt. Why would we want to have such strong beliefs? Why would we want to have such strong beliefs that we would be willing to pull the trigger and start a war and kill one another over these strong beliefs? So do you see how logically that the result of such strong convictions leading to war leads to a time of doubt? And there are three primary, well, I should say now, there are four primary responses to that. One of them is the Catholic response. We're just going to leave that to the side. You know, I don't want to spend any more time sort of teasing out Catholic doctrine. We've done enough of that already. So there's the Catholic response that ultimately ends in weakening the power of, no, I'm sorry, it ultimately ends in strengthening the power of the Pope through the Council of Trent. And then there are three other responses: rationalism, spiritualism, and pietism. We are primarily influenced in our tradition, and whether we recognize it or not, we are primarily individually influenced by rationalism and pietism. So we'll spend a bit of time on those and just a tiny bit of time on spiritualism. So rationalism. So these wars following the Reformation led to fundamental doubts, a doubt that truth could be understood through revelation. So if God says it, I believe it, that settles it. If that leads to war in both Britain and Europe, then people are beginning to think, maybe this strict sort of revelation of truth is not the wisest way to come to truth, to come to an understanding of reality. And so now we're going to talk about some philosophers, and I want to try to do this fairly quickly, but I will, partly because I won't be able to answer your questions if you ask them, okay? I can try, but may not be able to. But we are influenced by this progression of philosophical approach. So René Descartes began with valuing reason. So, oh my goodness, I have some of my college students or close to being college students who may have more recently gone to philosophy class than much more recently than me. But anyway, Descartes or Cartesian reasoning is something along those lines. We can doubt anything and everything. You can doubt that this is a cup if you want to. Okay? However, the one thing that Descartes could not doubt was his own existence or his own ability to think. So there are lots of coffee cups that say, "I think, therefore I am." Does this sound familiar to anybody? "I think, therefore I am." So he based his understanding of his own existence on the fact that he could not doubt the fact that he is thinking about stuff. All right? So do you see he's working from a position of doubt? You can doubt the existence of God, the existence of the universe, the existence of all the people around you, the hardness of oak. You can doubt all of these things. But you're thinking about these things while you're doubting them. And so he is basing his understanding of his own existence on his ability to think and moving from there. Okay, he is moving from there. Then he's thinking, well, then I exist, and so Greg is also thinking about things and doubting my existence while I'm doubting his. So he thinks, therefore he is, and we can kind of rebuild a universe of thought based on our own ability to think. All right, but it's built on doubt, isn't it? Right. So you see how doubt is becoming much more prominent than God said it through the Pope, I believe it, that settles it. Right? So doubt is the foundation of where we're headed here. John Locke rejects to some degree what Descartes is doing, and he values empiricism, which is oak is hard. This oak is hard. This oak is hard. So there is this empirical evidence that all oak is hard. You know, and so you can build sort of a thought universe on that because you can test. What is the scientific method, right? It is hypothesis, experimentation, synthesis, or something like that. But you're testing, all of your hypotheses you test. And so by testing your hypothesis, you can adjust what you were originally thinking. So we might say, well, oak that has been cured is hard. Oak that has been rotted is soft. You know, and so you kind of build a thought universe about reality and about God on empirical evidence. And so we are influenced by this, are we not? We look at the universe around us, and we say that there is a grand, unmoved mover, that there has to be a reason for the existence of all that is, beyond all that we can see, feel, touch, hear, and taste. There has to be something bigger and greater to create this grand universe. And so we have been influenced by this, the value of empiricism. However, this did lead to doubt about sort of the character of God, which led to deism. That is the idea that God started the universe. He instituted certain laws, both sort of spiritual laws, that if you lived a corrupted lifestyle, your body and your existence and your spirit will be corrupted is kind of a spiritual law. But if you set match to oak, it will burn. You know, so there are these physical and spiritual laws. God set up the universe with spiritual and physical laws, and then he just left it. He just left it alone. He is not personally involved in the universe or in our lives. That is deism. It's the idea that God wound up the clock and left it to do its own thing with all of the mechanical and spiritual laws that are related to it. So that this value of reason and of empiricism led to deism. And then eventually we get to France and Voltaire, who has another quite long name, but Voltaire is apparently his pen name. Voltaire begins to doubt reason altogether and the ability really to know anything or how we know things. And I know less about Voltaire, so he's doubting. Just the amount of doubt is building. So he's kind of the jerk in the back of the class that says, who says? Right? In high school. Who says? Who says? Just because you say? So Descartes and Locke are saying there's a better way to come to knowledge than just the Pope said so. So they are the ones saying to the Pope, who says? And he says to them, who says? You know, you think you're so smart. But who said? I mean, just you. You're no better than the Pope. So who says? And a certain amount of who cares. Okay? And then that all leads to Immanuel Kant, who starts to question what is knowledge or what is knowing. And this, if you want the fancy word for this is called epistemology. How do we know things? How do we understand things? And Immanuel Kant says that, all right, you strap it on here, okay, get ready. He says that our attempt at knowledge does not reflect reality as much as it reflects the structure of the human mind. So the best way to sort of understand this is that we have a tendency to pigeonhole data. So, oak is hard goes into the tree file in our brain and into the hardness/softness continuum file. right? And so we file this knowledge away. We do these things continuously, okay? So we even in a sort of religious realm, you know certain things about Reformed churches in DeMott, right? And you kind of, you are able to understand Reformed people and theology through a certain grid of knowledge. They baptize their infants, etc., etc. Okay, and so you file this knowledge away. And what he is saying is that our way of understanding dramatically affects our understanding. And so if we have a flaw in the filing system or in the pigeonholing system, then we will misunderstand reality. That's one of the results of it. And we are definitely influenced by this. I know that I am definitely influenced by this particular form of philosophy. However, he is also still, what he's doing is he's still calling into doubt not just, you know, our ability to understand through things through reason, but he is, I'm sorry, through revelation, he is calling into doubt our ability to understand things through reason at all. And so pretty soon, you can be sitting in church sort of asking yourself, am I really sitting in church? Or is that just a category in my mind? And really, I'm in a hospital bed on a drip that's keeping me, you know, in a dream state. Okay? And so you can, these things will play with your mind because they are all built upon doubt. All right? Is it any wonder that our world is filled with atheists and agnostics, having been influenced by these philosophies? Now, we also have been influenced by these philosophies. You watch me work from, you can take a line or a circle around all of these, and you can sort of label this rationalism, okay? You watch me preach a sermon that is interacting both reason and revelation every single Sunday. I believe in a reasonable faith. You probably wouldn't come to church here unless you also believed in a reasonable faith. You want something more than just God says it, so therefore go forth believing and doing. You want some depth to that that interacts with the world that we observe and the lives that we experience and explain the discrepancies or the apparent discrepancies between my experience and what the Bible may say. Why is it that that doesn't seem true all of the time? How do we deal with these things? And so you and I are very influenced by rationalism and that philosophy. We deal with empirical evidence as much as we possibly can. How do we look at the rocks and the bones and the fossils and correlate that with the scriptures? How do we deal with evidence and revelation? So that is one reaction to the Reformation, and it's built entirely on doubt. Any questions or comments about that? I'm unsure. I really don't know. That seems like an association in your mind? Right. I am unsure about that. The illustration, have you all heard that illustration? Three blind men, they come upon an elephant. One of them feels the leg and says that it's a tree. One of them feels the trunk and says that it's a snake, and one of them feels the tail and says that it's a rope. And of course, that illustration gets used a lot, and it gets used a lot to attack Christians. How do you know that you're so right? You know, you're just one blind man. The Buddhist is another blind man. The you know, the atheist is another blind man. But of course, the person that is telling that illustration to try to poo-poo your system is pretending as if they have 20/20 vision, and they can tell that all of the evidence leads to you are blind and don't know what you're talking about. But if I'm blind, he's blind. So anyway, the illustration falls apart. All right. So let's talk. Any other comments or questions about sort of this more philosophical reaction? Okay. Spiritualism. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I know very little about it, actually, partly. Spiritualism is really the Quakers and those like them. George Fox, 1624 to 1661, was greatly persecuted for being a Quaker in England. He was beaten a number of times. He spent a significant amount of time in jail because he rejected this rationalism, and he also rejected external revelation, and he embraced internal revelation. So what he referred to as the inner light, basically saying that God, the work of the Holy Spirit, is to give to you this personal, private, inner revelation. So we've referred to this before. The Quakers, when they come to the meeting, they don't refer to it really as church, but when they come to the meeting at the meeting house, they all sit there quietly and just meditate. And they may meditate for a space of time, and then they all just quietly leave. Or someone may receive an inner light, an inner revelation, and if so, they're allowed to speak it and share that with other people. So they do not have any paid pastors, and they depend upon this inner light. So it's very private and personal, and of course can go off in all kinds of different directions. He did, however, believe in religious toleration, which was the greatest influence that we have received through him, through William Penn in Pennsylvania. So Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. Come here, have your inner light, I'll have my inner light, and we'll all get along. We're not going to fight about these things, because it's personal, it's private, and we're going to allow the various religious groups to coexist there in Pennsylvania. So William Penn was a direct follower of George Fox. However, of course, there's great dangers in this. I mean, you know, I run across this more frequently when people tell me that things like God said, and then they don't quote a Bible verse. You know, they just said, you know, God told me to apply for a new job. Or God told me to, I used to use this illustration a lot many years ago, move to Nevada and raise Nubian goats. You know, just God told me to do this. And I hear, you know, maybe I'm their pastor. I mean, I've had to do this with people who have been members of the church. And I have to say, you know, I'm your pastor. I'm supposed to be part of the spiritual part of your life. And you're just telling me stuff. I have no way to verify this. You know, I have no way to deal with this. Or in a dream or vision, God said this to me or revealed that to me. Well, you know, how can I even interact with that? I didn't experience the dream. God didn't say anything to me. I don't know if this is related to your mental stability, your emotional stability, or if this is, you know, there is no external way to even evaluate this. You have set yourself up as your own authority when you do that kind of maneuver. And so this is spiritualism that doesn't elevate reason, doesn't elevate revelation, it elevates the self, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, it elevates self-revelation. And it is alive and well outside of the Society of Friends, which is the label for Quakers. It is alive and well outside of that in evangelicalism because so many people just, you know, God spoke to me this and God spoke to me that. And what I want to hear is, you know, God spoke to me through this verse, you know, and it applied to my life in that way. Or God spoke to me through the music this morning. The hymn reminded me of God's grace or reminded me of my need for commitment. And that's what I want. I want to hear some external revelation connected to God's speaking. Any questions about that or the Quakers or this movement? Okay. It's intriguing, isn't it? This reaction, this response to, you know, we don't want to be quite so dogmatic that it leads us to war. And so consequently, we're going to elevate some other things in our ability to understand the world around us and God. Now, the one that has held as much sway as any other in evangelicalism is pietism. And I learned some things about the beginnings of pietism that I had not known before. So let me share some of that with you. So the beginnings of pietism go back to 1635, or that would be the birth of Philip Jacob Spener. As an adult, he becomes a pastor in Frankfurt, Germany. So we are back to the roots of the Reformation here in Germany. So he becomes a pastor in Frankfurt, Germany. And he took the doctrine of the priesthood of the believer, coming from Luther and the reaction against the clergy-laity divide in the Catholic Church, he takes the doctrine of the priesthood of the believer, and he takes that to mean that the laity should be involved in more intense personal and small group devotion and Bible study. So can you see already the influence that this has on our tradition? Priesthood of the believer means you as a congregation have a right and responsibility to study the scriptures, to seek to understand them on your own. It does not mean, pietism in no way means that God has not given teachers to the church, that God does give the spiritual gift of teaching to some, and consequently, they are our helpers in understanding and interpreting the scriptures. But everyone has an opportunity and a responsibility to be devoted to the Lord and to study the scriptures. So he started these groups for Bible study and devotion. They were called Colleges of Piety. And so in some ways, Spener was filling in the blanks that Luther left regarding sanctification. So let me get a drink here and we'll take a deep breath in. Right. Okay. So he's filling in the blanks that were left by Luther. So I haven't really started reading this book, but I have recently purchased a book on the Reformation and several of the primary leaders of the Reformation, just to kind of read during this year, which is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And the first chapter is on Luther, and it refers to Luther as God's volcano. Okay, and hopefully you've gotten that picture, that Luther was kind of this one big explosion, and then he really kind of, even personally and spiritually, there was a certain amount of decline. He became vitriolic and pretty ornery. He said some things that have been very regrettable, wrote some things that are very regrettable after that initial Reformation. He was God's explosion to just blow everything to pieces, right? And then Calvin and Philip Melanchthon and John Knox and others kind of picked those pieces up and formed a Protestant theology. Well, God used him to do that. And the one big explosion was the doctrine of justification. We are justified by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. Okay? And he was a one-nail hammer. Okay? He pounded that nail of justification every time he preached the Word of God. And so, maybe two. Justification by faith, and the Pope is the Antichrist. Justification by faith, and the Pope is the Antichrist. And, you know, it's kind of like if you are a hammer, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem is a nail, right? And so you just beat, and his only tool was justification, and so everything was related to justification. And so essentially what's happening here under Spener, and I'm sure others as well, is they're kind of filling in the blanks about sanctification. How do we become personally more godly after we've been justified by grace through faith? And Luther did have a theology of sanctification, but he didn't emphasize it very much. And he kept coming back to justification, justification, justification. This is a very real debate in our world today. One, so you guys may not connect the labels here, but I am influenced by something called the Gospel Coalition. It's a ministry that I appreciate, shall we say. So it was started by two men, Tim Keller and Don Carson. If Don Carson wrote a commentary on a New Testament book that I'm going to preach through, I will read that commentary. He is the premier New Testament scholar in the world today. Tim Keller started Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York and is hugely influential in evangelical circles today when it comes to preaching and church planting. He's very, very influential. And they started the Gospel Coalition. Somebody got kicked out of the Gospel Coalition a couple of years ago because they refused to develop a theology of sanctification. They refused to develop a theology of sanctification, and they kept pounding away on, if you understand grace, salvation by grace, you will, by definition, be so grateful for that grace that you will become holy. Well, after a couple of affairs, people began to realize there's a problem with his theology. Okay, and before the affairs were known, I think maybe just one affair. I should be careful what I say here. But even before that, they kicked him off the website because he would not develop the sort of human effort side of sanctification. Are we saved by human effort? Absolutely not. But does growth in holiness require human effort? Absolutely. You must pray. God does not pray for you. You must pray. You must, shall I say, bow your head and pray. Or, you know, look at the beauty of the world and pray. You must resist temptation. God does not resist temptation for you. And so there is a human effort side to sanctification. He rejected that in a Lutheran kind of way. Not that Luther would have done what he did, but nevertheless, he left that blank. And Spener is filling in that blank, one of the first ones to fill that blank in for Lutheranism. And he emphasized personal relationship with God and the need for personal effort in our growth in sanctification. Let me pause there and see if there's any questions. So there's a modern book written by Kevin DeYoung. The most recent time we watched a video in this class, it was preached by Kevin DeYoung. And his book on this issue is The Hole in Our Holiness. And he's talking about the necessary human effort to pursue after holiness. That is the influence of pietism. Any comments or questions? All right, the second bullet point there. There are these couple of contributions of pietism. Because of the emphasis of one of Spener's specific followers, August Hermann Frank, pietism began to be associated with something like a second blessing. So this is something that Frank experienced. It's also something that John Wesley experienced. It's something also that D.L. Moody experienced. And it's this idea that you seek after God, and 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 you ramp up the intensity of your seeking, perhaps even somewhat artificially, perhaps that would be a critique, you ramp up this passionate seeking of God until you have God pour out upon you so much of His unexplained spiritual presence upon you by the Holy Spirit that you can't take it anymore. So kind of the famous phrase from D.L. Moody would be, I had to ask God to stay his hand and not press in upon me as sort of these waves came across the shore of his consciousness of just the fireworks of God's glory, love, pursuit of him personally, you know, the depth of the atonement, all of these things that there, and not that there is anything wrong with that, but to require it of everyone is misguided. Some personalities are more attuned to this kind of experience, and it can be faked. And so you must not require this kind of experience of someone that is not required in the Scriptures. So he's saying to truly be sanctified or to go to the next step. So maybe someone, well, they'll resist the temptation to drunkenness and to lust and to anger, but to really move into the depths of holiness, you must experience this second blessing. And that's not what they called it. That's a more modern term. It's a more charismatic term. But it's that idea that to move to the next step, you've kind of gotten as close to God as you're going to get without it. You must have this. You must. Some phrases are used. You must pray through. You must receive the second blessing. You must get to the point where you have to ask God to stay his hand. And that is really a misunderstanding of sanctification, and it's imposing the experience of some on all. And I will just go ahead and confess that my personality is not inclined to this sort of thing. And I have to try to be patient with those who would be inclined towards that sort of thing, but also let them know you cannot biblically require this of everyone. So, and any comments or questions, that's one contribution, negative contribution, I would say, of pietism. And then another one that is very, very positive is pietism really starts the first wave of missionary fervor coming out of the Reformation. So the Reformers, the original Reformers, like they're just dealing with, you know, staying out of jail, keeping their neck out of the noose, and sort of building up a basic theology for the church. They're rebuilding everything, the theology, the churches themselves, you know, the how we do church without a pope and a hierarchy and all of these things. Should churches be national churches, independent churches, all of these things that we've talked about over the last month or so, they didn't have time to really think about missions very much. But the pietists are able to do so. They begin to pursue after missions. And one evidence of that is in 1707, the King of Denmark, who is an admirer of the pietists, he wants to send missionaries to his colonies, his colonial holdings in India. And the only people that would volunteer for missionary duty were the pietists. And so he sends a couple of missionaries over there, and then he starts a school of missions in Denmark for the sending of missionaries to his other colonies. Now, along with that is the Moravian missionary effort, which is really much bigger and more influential than that. So let me talk about Count Zinzendorf and the Moravians for a moment. So his name is Count Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf. And you can see the connections here. Zinzendorf's godfather was Spener, the father of pietism. Zinzendorf was very wealthy. He was German. He had like ancestral holdings. He was of the nobility, had a castle, had all of the land and the system of villagers and villages that, you know, worked the land and were craftsmen in his area. It's this sort of nobility-based economy that we've talked about before that is falling apart at this point in history, but nevertheless, he is still a part of that and has those ancestral holdings. He studied under August Hermann Frank, who we mentioned before, Spinner's prize student. And he repeatedly clashed with the Orthodox Lutheran teachers. So he did a number of things. He was very wealthy. He was able to travel around Europe, and he could go and he could study under Frank. And he could then go to Wittenberg, where, you know, the 95 Theses were pounded on the door. He could go there and he could study there. And he was on this sort of pursuit of religious and spiritual training. Well, when he got to Wittenberg, he was constantly clashing with the sort of Lutheran orthodoxy that was there. It was becoming sort of stiff and staid. They weren't moving beyond Luther very much, and he wanted more. He wanted more emphasis on personal holiness, and he wasn't getting it there. Eventually, he meets a group of Moravians. Now, we've actually talked about the Moravians once before. Do you remember John Huss, who is from Bohemia and nearby Moravia? And he is burned at the stake by the Catholics for his heresies. But he had been preaching. He wasn't fully a Protestant, but he had been preaching salvation by grace. He was mad because the laity only received the bread and not the cup at communion. Do you remember any of this? John Huss. He eventually gets burned at the stake. But he had planted the seeds, and these people became known as Hussites. And the Hussites spread around from Bohemia to Moravia, and these Moravians come to faith in Christ. They reject and rebel against the Catholic Church, and then they are persecuted. They are driven out of their homeland. And lo and behold, some of them eventually, kind of generation by generation, some of them eventually, these Moravian Hussites, they run into Count Zinzendorf, and they're refugees. And he says, "Hey, I'm rich. You come live at my castle." And so they come and live at his castle, and they kind of have a little community going on there, almost like a commune, almost like a monastery. There's a great deal of religious zeal. They influence Zinzendorf. Zinzendorf influences them, and they get along fairly well. And there's land here, so they can grow food, and they become a part of sort of this declining system where they kind of work the land, and they are spiritually being discipling one another. And they found this community called Herrnhut. I have no idea if I'm saying it correctly, but something like that. Oh, we have a German with us. Say it again. Herrnhut. Okay. So, have you been there? Have you seen this? Okay. No, I'm not questioning your pronunciation, but I know you spent some time in Germany, so.
I haven't heard of it.
Okay. All right. So anyway, there's this nice little community going on here. But then in 1731, Zinzendorf makes a trip to Denmark, I believe, and he meets some Eskimos that have been won to Christ by Lutheran missionaries, right? So these missionaries that the King of Denmark sent out, they were Lutherans. Denmark is Lutheran at this point in time. And so they come back. They come back to Denmark, and they show off their converts, right? And he meets these Eskimos, and God sparks within Zinzendorf's heart a zeal for missions. And within a few years, they start sending out missionaries. So he influences the Moravians, and they start going on the mission field. They go to Central America. They go to the Caribbean first. So their first missionaries are sent out to the Caribbean. Why are they sent out to the Caribbean? They know that slavery is very strong in the Caribbean. It's the only way that they could really support the sugar plantations, so they send missionaries to the Caribbean to minister to those African slaves. Eventually, within a few years, they send out over 100 missionaries to Africa, India, and North and South America. This movement was started, the Moravian movement was started by only 200 refugees, and now they have sent out 100 missionaries. You had to have a really good reason to not go to the mission field if you were going to be a Moravian at Herrnhut. Okay, And they really meant business about spreading the gospel and sacrificially serving God. Now, in Pennsylvania, we've actually kind of mentioned this before, some of them also went to Pennsylvania, where they are not going to be persecuted for their faith, of course, and they started Bethlehem, the city of Bethlehem, and Nazareth in Pennsylvania. And I've been in the Moravian Church. It's one of those stately, colonial-style churches there in Bethlehem. These are also the people that you may have heard of who would sometimes sell themselves into slavery so that they could minister to the African slaves on the ships and at the ports and on the plantations. Their lifespan was not very long as missionaries because of the brutality of their lives. But they were known to be the slaves of the slaves. We might question some portions of pietism, but I would be happy to be influenced by these sacrificial servants of God in many, many ways. So that is that kind of brings us to a stopping point, because John Wesley is converted to salvation. He understands salvation by grace through faith instead of by human effort when he meets a bunch of Moravians on a missions trip to North America. And that will lead us into discussing John and Charles Wesley and their influence on England and at their contemporaries, George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards here in North America. Go ahead. Yes, and I don't know all of the connections to keep those dots connected. Oh, okay, here's what I would say. The Amish, the Mennonites, and the Hussites are all in this pietistic camp. So probably the Hussites were part of the influence that taught the original Menno-Sims and other leaders in that movement. So the Amish and the Mennonites come from the Anabaptist movement in Germany, and the Anabaptist movement was influenced by the Hussites. Yeah. Any other comments or questions? To me, this is a very cool time of church history because of the birth of so many things kind of going on here. It's kind of the second harvest of the Reformation reality in Europe and the United States. Okay, thanks for listening in. You're dismissed, and we'll gather for worship here in a bit.